Could I have your... Hello. If I could interrupt... I would suggest everybody continue eating, and we'll continue talking. If you don't know who our next speaker is, you're in the wrong room. The shoe repair convention's down the hall, and this is not the cat's paw man. This is Harvey Miller, who is the leader of our area, and who bears no introduction because he is the number one, always has been, and always will be, bankruptcy lawyer on the face of the planet. So without further ado, I'll introduce Harvey Miller.
For a moment there, I thought we were going to get a eulogy. Good afternoon. Great pleasure to be here again. To make it another year is an accomplishment. Today, it is my honor to present to the Miller Award to Harrison J. Golden, the man who grew up eating Twinkies. Harrison J. Golden, also known as J. Golden, is truly a Renaissance man. He is a multi-talented giant at whatever endeavor he chooses to pursue. He brings to all of his assignments a broad spectrum of experience, expertise, intelligence, and integrity. Integrity can sometimes be a problem. Allow me to illustrate the point. It was October 1975. Economic conditions were terrible. On October 2, 1975, the first billion-dollar Chapter 11 case was filed, WT Grant Company. Almost immediately after the organizational meeting for that case, I received a telephone call. I was told that New York City was in crisis. The call was from City Hall. Abe Beam was the mayor, and some strange man was the controller of the city of New York, Mr. Golden. What had happened was the city, like some other companies, kept borrowing money and kept borrowing money every day. And one day, Chase Manhattan Bank showed up and said, before we advance any money, we would like to have a certification that the city is solvent. And who has to sign that certification but Mr. Golden? Mr. Golden immediately looked at his personal assets and said, I don't think so. And the crisis began. The bank said there'll be no money for the city of New York unless there's a certification. Liquidity was disappearing very rapidly. And one night, very soon thereafter, it happened to be the day of the Alfred E. Smith dinner, which honored all the politicians, including the president, I found myself in Gracie Mansion in the basement with a team of lawyers and accountants trying to figure out what in the hell are we going to do with the city of New York? President Ford had told the city to go to hell. Where was Mr. Golden? He was at the Alfred E. Smith dinner, right? And here was this team working in the basement of Gracie Mansion all day, and not a stitch of food. No water, no soda, nothing. And the PR guy for the city, a guy by the name of Sidney Fregant, was sitting in the corner typing away furiously. And I walked over to Sid and I said, Sid, what are you doing? And he said, what do you think I'm doing? I'm typing out my resume. I have two kids to send to college. Well, at about 11 o'clock, there's a long staircase coming down into the basement of Gracie Mansion. A man starts walking down the stairs in white tie and tails. And I said, at last, the maitre d' is coming to take orders. It was the mayor. And after the mayor, people kept coming in formal dress, including Jay. And the question was, here we are, we're running out of liquidity. What's going to happen to the city of New York? And sitting around this table with the mayor and with Jay, I said, well, how much money does the city have? We have to take care of sanitation, police, fire. And Jay said, we have a zero balance. And that went back and forth for a while. And I said, you can't have a zero balance. There must be money in the float. And the deputy controller said, yes, there's about $60 million in the float. And we said, well, now we have some money to pay for all of these services. And this little guy is sitting in the corner, Mr. Golden, says, absolutely not. My obligation is to the bondholders. You can't use that money. And we argued for a while. And he said, can't use that money. Well, what were we going to do? We put Jay into a closet and locked the door. And the next day, we had the police, the fire department, and the sanitation workers all lined up. We actually had a judge sign an order putting the city into receivership. But what, as I recall, Jay, what happened was the sanitation workers came through with a bridge loan, and then Big Mac came along. That was a very interesting evening. As you can tell, for many years, Jay has been was a public servant. He served as controller of the city of New York for 16 years and may be one of the few controllers of this great city who wasn't touched by any scandal. Now my notes are screwed up here. He was also a member of the New York State Assembly. However, after 16 years as controller, he decided to be the mayor. After a forceful and eloquent campaign in the primary, he ended up like the New York Jets, licking his wounds. It was a loss for the city, but a great gain for the restructuring world. Jay has served in numerous restructurings as a chief executive officer, chief reorganization officer, trustee, examiner, and financial advisors. These cases include Drexel Burnham Lambert, Enron North America, Bruno Supermarkets, Loral Space and Communications, Mona Capital Corp, Rockefeller Center Properties, and many others. In his well over 40 years of experience in both the business, financial, and public sectors, he has demonstrated his objectiveness, skills, and persuasive talents. He's a shrewd negotiator. Doing a deal with Jay is interesting. At the conclusion, you hardly notice that you are leaving without your socks, not to mention your shoes. One could go on for a long time talking about Jay's experiences, but there's one extremely interesting experience that he had. As an attorney with the Department of Justice in the hectic days of racial integration, a tempest was brewing at the University of Mississippi in Oxford, Mississippi, otherwise known as Ole Miss. James Meredith, a black man, was insisting upon enrolling in Ole Miss, an all-white, conservative, or even reactionary institution as far as racial integration was concerned. President Kennedy and his brother Bob Kennedy were very concerned there would be blood on the ground if Mr. Meredith persisted. Every effort was made to persuade Mr. Meredith to relent. He refused. In one of those tumultuous days, Jay's phone rang, and it was Nicholas Katzenbach, the Attorney General. He informed Jay that Jay was on his way to Mississippi, where he was going to become the roommate of James Meredith. It was an environment filled with tension, and it was Jay's responsibility, all 5, 6, 7 feet, to shadow Meredith's every movement and indeed counsel Meredith. During that period, there was going to be a classic football game scheduled between Ole Miss and one of its regional sectional rivals. Meredith decided that he was going to attend the football game. Something like that had never happened at Ole Miss. Jay was directed to persuade Meredith that going to the football game was a bad idea. That may have been the one occasion that Jay was out-negotiated and Meredith insisted upon attending the game. True to his task, Jay provided the coverage. He played Clint Eastwood and demonstrated the courage with which he has met hedge funds and distressed debt traders. Meredith survived, and so did Jay. It shows the measure of the man. Jay is a major figure in our world of restructurings and bankruptcy. He's an honor graduate from Princeton University and Yale Law School, and a Woodrow Wilson Fellow at the Harvard Graduate School. He honors me by accepting the Miller Award. Jay is also a great family man, with his lovely wife, Diana, his three wonderful sons, and their wives and children. I've lost count of the number of grandchildren, but I know that he greatly enjoys each of them and he enjoys everything there is in life. As I said, he is truly a Renaissance man. Jay, it's my great honor to present you with this award.
Well, those are exceptionally flattering remarks that lead me to think that if Harvey will lie, I'll swear to it. I'm delighted to receive this honor, especially because it's presented by Harvey Miller, who, as all of us know, is widely acknowledged as a dean of the restructuring world, and because the award bears his distinguished name. And I am mindful that the catalog of award recipients who precede me include some of the most prestigious people in our industry. So I thank Beard Publications for being willing to dilute the luster of the awards brand by adding my name to the pantheon of its recipients. I want to thank all of you for coming. I decided that because I was admonished about the time restrictions that I ought to put some of my remarks in writing and not deliver them extemporaneously. Reminds me of the story they tell about the corporate CEO who was a mean and nasty fellow. Everybody hated him. He was gratuitously horrible to all of the people who worked for him. He was about to give a major speech before the New York Society of Security Analysts, and his speechwriter decided that this was going to be the last speech on which he would work. So the CEO stood up before this very important audience of financial professionals, delivered his remarks, turning the pages, and came to a point at which he said, "We at our company are on the brink of a major turnaround because we have established a 10-point program of specific changes which are going to result in an improvement in our earnings and a dramatic rise in our stock price. Number one," and he turned the page, and the speechwriter had written across the top, "Okay, you SOB, now you're on your own." Over the decades in which I have followed macroeconomic trends, I don't recall ever seeing an environment as opaque as the one we're now navigating. Contraindicative trends abound, making it unusually difficult to discern the direction of the economy, both domestic and international, and concomitantly the outlook for the restructuring business. Harry Truman once famously said, "There can't be a one-handed economist." His folksy aphorism continues to hold. On the one hand, evidence abounds that the system is awash in liquidity, with corporate balance sheets unprecedentedly robust, banks loaded with cash, uncommitted private equity funding pushing past $400 billion, and perhaps the cheapest, most robust, high-yield market in history. On the other hand, companies are restrained by uncertainty over tax and monetary policy. Banks remain on tenterhooks as to, among other things, Basel III, and private equity commitments are constrained by a fierce competitive environment for deals, meaning that in nearly every instance, a competitor is willing to commit an incremental dollar, even to the point of ultimately jeopardizing the economic viability of the deal. To be sure, marquee credits can finance virtually at will, and middle market companies feast on a frenzy for return in the high yield market. But for the vast number of smaller companies, isn't it weird that a billion-dollar business is no longer mid-cap? Access to credit is constrained. Underwriting standards are high at this end of the market. a threat of a meaningful boost in interest rates less than 24 months out is a not insignificant inhibition in the sector of the credit markets. And overall market and economic uncertainty create the kind of pervasive doubt that is inimical to robust investment activity. All of this is apart from the train wreck in slow motion that is the Eurozone and the impending disaster of the fiscal cliff. Each, if not handled responsibly, has the potential to add dramatic uncertainty and wild volatility to global markets. For example, as respects the fiscal cliff, IMF models under a worst-case scenario suggest a 4.8% reduction in GDP growth in the U.S., throwing the country back into a full-fledged recession. Now, I'm not focusing on these potential mega crises this afternoon because, although I am far removed from the active practice of politics, I believe that in the United States there will be a last-minute resolution that will avoid an irresponsible failure to reach a deal and to risk the potential of the kind of chaos that followed Lehman's collapse in September 2008. Speaker Boehner clearly wants a deal. His Majority Leader Eric Cantor, who fancies himself the champion of the most conservative Republican members of the House, is leading a cadre that is in the main chastened, confused, and apprehensive. Whatever President Obama's bravado, he recognizes that an impasse would have effects way beyond those considered by President Clinton when he followed through on his threat to precipitate a government shutdown. And from President Obama's standpoint, that is a result which is both much to be avoided and that warrants meaningful compromise. I am considerably less sanguine about the outlook for the Eurozone, but that is a story for another day. So, if in the face of the current confusing, competing financial and economic equities, early 2013 were to bring at least some measure of clarity, what are the implications for the restructuring world in which we operate? Since my remarks were mandated to be brief and not a PhD thesis, I want to speak to just one area in which a significant imperative is likely to continue to exert an adverse effect on corporate viability, virtually without regard to the macroeconomic environment. I have in mind the certainty of continued and perhaps enhanced governmental regulation. One not need subscribe wholly to Ronald Reagan's famous cynicism about government's role in the economy. If it moves, tax it. If it keeps moving, regulate it. And if it stops moving, subsidize it. To recognize that while rules relating to the workplace, health and welfare, occupational safety, the ease of unionization and the like, affect most businesses, in some industries, regulation can have a strangling effect, both because of its impact and its unpredictability. Examples abound. Healthcare, energy, transportation, for-profit education, and so forth. But let's consider just one sector by way of illustration. Telecommunications and the role of the FCC. To be sure, the rapid pace of technological advancement requires vigilance to ensure that citizens have reasonable access to communications and that new and promising technologies are not undermined by vested interests that dominate a delivery system. But the regulatory effect of the FCC can be devastating for a wide array of companies. LightSquared is a good example of a binary regulatory decision, quickly and dramatically altering a company's status and value. A light squared term loan, trading near par in August 2011, plummeted to the high 30s after the FCC announced it would restrict the use of the company's primary asset, mobile satellite spectrum. The company plunged into bankruptcy. Fiber Tower, for which Golden Associates is the financial advisor to the Official Committee of Unsecured Creditors, is another example of a company's finances and viability profoundly affected by FCC action. The debtor attempted to use Chapter 11 to wind down its unprofitable legacy backhaul wireless business and reorganize around its more promising wireless spectrum assets. But the FCC has declared that the company has not satisfied certain capital requirements and is seeking to reclaim its wireless spectrum assets. The rural local exchange carrier space is another example of the crushing effect of FCC regulation on companies' prospects and value. Having decided to move away from the Universal Service Fund program and into the Connect America Fund, the FCC has severely altered the business models and prospects of such companies as Otelco and Alaska Communications. So, I hope the point is clear. Whatever the outlook for the economy, however markets may move, wherever interest rates may be headed, and abundant liquidity notwithstanding, at least on a selective basis, and a big selection it is, one need not despair about the prospects for restructuring professionals. As I like to say, does the doctor pray for the plague? Of course not. Distress is part of the human condition. And as always, those of us who provide restructuring advice, turnaround management services, and litigation support will continue to be there to help. Now, I am mindful that every year the recipient of this award is asked to give some advice to distressed investors, not just a pep talk to restructuring professionals. So I want to conclude with some words that are relevant to my remarks as build. I can think of no more relevant or topical an issue around which to focus comments relative to distressed investors than the unfortunate failure of the reorganization efforts of Hostess Brands, something that has been unfolding in real time. It is a widely reported bankruptcy that is much misunderstood. It is also a cautionary tale for distressed investors and turnaround professionals alike. Hostess, unlike most food manufacturers, is a DSD, direct store delivery company, whose success has more to do with how it delivers its product than how it makes it. It operates a huge fleet of trucks and has more employees in the Teamsters Union than in the Bakers Union. Its drivers are the front line of its sales and marketing efforts. The business depends on how many stores they can visit on their route each day, their ability to make their product look good on the shelves, and whether they can use their local relationships to get better positioning in the stores, among many other factors. Hostess's drivers are paid by the hour for time expended during the workday. They have little incentive to sell bread and cake. By contrast, drivers at Hostess's leading competitors operate like small business owners or entrepreneurs and can earn more if they're able to make business on their routes grow. The company had the opportunity to fix this problem during the bankruptcy of its predecessor, Interstate Bakeries. Interstate proposed a bankruptcy plan led by Silver Point, whereby Silver Point and others would invest fresh capital to restructure the company's DSD strategies and routes. At that time, the Bakers Union supported the plan, even though it called for greater concessions than employees had previously agreed to. The Teamsters, however, refused to agree to the plan because of the significant changes to proposed routes and work rules, even though its members would have had the ability to make more under that plan. They could also earn less, with the average employee estimated to continue to make the same economic concessions as the Bakers. Now, part of what the Interstate saga illustrates is that investing in a turnaround based on the assumption of a turnaround in revenue and sales is the riskiest kind of turnaround investing. In fact, it is not turnaround investing at all. It is the equivalent of venture capital investing, and the distressed investor needs to recognize that. Let me explain. It is generally understood that a major problem with Hostess and its predecessor, Interstate Bakeries, was that the company, once the largest U.S. bread manufacturer, had done nothing in the face of significant changes in American eating habits and fell behind competitors that had taken market share with whole grain products. Those same changes had caused the consumer to purchase fewer snack cakes. The business plan with which the company emerged from its first bankruptcy depended upon adapting to this trend. It was based on union concessions that gave the company a 2-year window to solve the problem with the introduction of new products. But the problem never got fixed. And while many are highly critical of the Bakers Union and its employees for rejecting the company's final offer in the current bankruptcy, while the Teamsters agreed to it, the Bakers' decision may be anything but irrational. Consider the following. The bakery industry today has considerable overcapacity, the result of changing consumption patterns. The bakeries that will be closed in the coming years will likely belong to less efficient, less competitive market participants. And with the biggest factor in the labor costs of making cupcakes, not manufacturing, but the efficiency of the root structures and DSD capabilities, Hostess today looks much the same as it did 3 years ago. It is the less efficient of the major players. So even were the Bakers to agree to concessions, the company would not be fixed, and there would be a continuing cycle of plant closings and additional demand for concessions. By contrast, if the company is liquidated and the brand sold, the buyers will still have to bake bread and cakes. To be sure, the buyers will not likely need all the bakeries in all markets, but many will continue to operate. Thus, Hostess's bakers will continue to have jobs, while the Teamsters will overwhelmingly lose theirs. Which is why the Teamsters agreed to the concessions, while the Bakers did not. For the distressed investor, the message is clear. Avoid the trap of thinking the solution is nearly always the top line. Master thoroughly the intricacies of the business model and mind carefully the motivations of labor. Their leaders tend to be no less rational than do any other participants in restructurings. Again, I thank Beard Publications for this award and all of you for honoring me by your presence and attention to my remarks. Thank you very much.